From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The redacted Mueller report is public. The ball is now in Congress's court. Robert Mueller determined there was not a prosecutable conspiracy case to be made against the Trump campaign. The special prosecutor didn't recommend prosecuting the president for obstruction of justice. That leaves the question for Congress. We'll have 2 hours of reaction and analysis right after the news.
No collusion, no obstruction.
There never was, by the way, and there never will be. And we do have to get to the bottom of these things, I will say. And this should never happen. I say this in front of my friends, wounded warriors, and I just call them warriors because we just shook hands and they look great. They look so good, so beautiful. But I say it in front of my friends, this should never happen to another president again. This hoax, this should never happen to another president again.
President Trump earlier this morning at an event honoring wounded veterans. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. We're shifting our 2 hours today to accommodate NPR's live coverage of the redacted Mueller report release. We're with you until 1 o'clock this afternoon. BBC NewsHour comes your way at 1, and then All Things Considered with an early start today at 2 o'clock as we cover the report throughout the course here on KPEC. Well, a number of different significant findings of the Mueller report that you've heard discussed over these past several hours here on KPCC. But let me introduce first Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst, joining us from San Francisco. Sean, how the president has characterized this versus 10 different episodes in which the president appeared to try and curtail the Mueller investigation. How do you square that?
Well, I mean, the bottom line is I think Mueller and his team went in with the overarching view of what the Justice Department has determined on two separate occasions when an impeachment and the potential removal of a president was brought forward. First, the Office of Legal Counsel in 1974, their interpretation that a sitting president cannot be indicted. And then when Bill Clinton was in office, they did a similar review and interpretation that the president couldn't be removed. So I think what he did was say that, you know, here are some things that President Trump did. They look sketchy, I think, to put a kind face on it. He gives it to Congress, and if Congress thinks that that is enough to move forward with impeachable offenses and then a conviction in the Senate, so be it. So I think that was the framework from the Mueller side of the equation. He put out that there was no collusion with Russia, and usually when you get into trouble, it's when you try and cover things up afterwards. And even though it looks like President Trump walked up to the line, I would say, at least in my review of the report so far, it doesn't look like he crossed the line.
And I think the term he used is conspiracy, which I believe is the legal term that's at play there. Also joining us is Amanda Renteria, chair of Emerge America, an organization that cultivates and trains Democratic women for political office. She was Hillary Clinton's political director during the 2016 campaign. Amanda, good to have you with us again. Your thoughts now on where Congress should go.
Well, I as you look through all the pages and pages, and I've been skimming it all this morning, I remember my days on the Hill. I spent about 10 years in the Senate, and I know there are hundreds of staffers right now really reading through all the different texts. And what I will say is it really has revealed some very tangible conversations, a number of things that I know Congress will be looking into, and staffers right now are actually looking up history. They're looking up what has happened in the past, because this is a long document with a lot of tangible pieces to follow. I take away a couple of things. One is there's just a breadth of information here. Number two, the actions by Barr this morning and the pre-press release or the pre-press statement and press conferences are really red flags. And then number three is, as you read through this, I think where we first started, you know, it is laying out information, and now the Congress has to figure out what are we going to do with that information and what do we have here? What lines of investigation do we need to keep following?
Let's hear from Bill Barr, the Attorney General, who this morning held a news conference about 90 minutes before the Mueller report in redacted form was publicly released.
As the special counsel report makes clear, the Russian government sought to interfere in our election process. But thanks to the special counsel's thorough investigation, we now know that the Russian operatives who perpetrated these schemes did not have the cooperation of President Trump or the Trump campaign, or the knowing assistance of any other American, for that matter. That is something that all Americans can and should be grateful to have confirmed.
And then Mr. Barr went on to use the term collusion that President Trump has used throughout his defense against the Mueller investigation.
But the special counsel found no evidence that any American, including anyone associated with the Trump campaign, conspired or coordinated with the Russian government or the IRA in this illegal scheme. Indeed, as the report states, quote, the investigation did not identify evidence that any U.S. person knowingly or intentionally coordinated with the IRA's interference operation, unquote. Put another way, the special counsel found no collusion by any Americans in IRA's illegal activities.
The IRA is the Internet Research Agency. It's a Russian company that American officials believe has close ties to the Russian government. And the Attorney General there talking about the efforts of IRA to sow social discord through disinformation and social media operations. Amanda Renteria, what in Bill Barr's sort of preface for the release of the Mueller report did you feel was misleading or mischaracterized the findings of the report?
Well, number one, just in the process that he did it, right? He didn't do a press conference after this report was out so that he could answer any concerns or any questions. Instead, what he did is he came out to frame something. That in itself is unusual, unprecedented, and really something that causes some questions and concerns for folks on the Hill who will be looking at this. Number two, he did use careful language. He said evidence. He didn't say admissible evidence. And when you read the report, you can see the careful construction that Mueller used when talking about conspiracy versus collusion. I think the third thing is the broad conversation when he says no one has had conversations, or that in addition to his very clear declarative that there is nothing here. He is one person, one view, and he's very well aware that Congress has a role to have their own judgment and their own review of this, as well as the public.
I guess I didn't hear in what he said anything attempting to foreclose congressional action. I thought he was speaking very directly about the Justice Department's role and essentially defending why justice wasn't going to prosecute for obstruction of justice. But you felt as though he was trying to foreclose Congress from investigating?
The fact that he used language, his declarative language was so broad in terms of no one has had interactions with, is a real question. And there's some lines of investigation, not to mention quite a bit of redactions in here, that are still left untold. And so I do think he was talking about the justice system, but the fact that he did a press conference prior to Congress getting any kind of information is in and of itself concerning, and sends a message to Congress about his belief in how much they should know before he has to actually answer any questions. And that's a real concern for our institutional systems.
Hmm. Although, I mean, it was the Justice Department who was overseeing this. So it's sort of it was their ball, and now the ball goes to Congress. Sean Walsh, your thoughts about the decision of Barr to hold the news conference before anyone could see the report?
Well, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but let's put
Please
a couple
don't.
Things very clearly on the table. So the special counsel law, when it was instituted, required that the special counsel report back to Congress on any findings. So the whole Lawrence Walsh issue, the Starr issue, et cetera. when you impanel a special counsel through the Department of Justice, their responsibilities are to report back to the Department of Justice. And in this case, Mr. Barr did not find collusion with Russia. And as you noted earlier, Larry, that the issue is not obstruction, but it's conspiracy to violate the law. And so neither one of those were proven out in as far as the Mueller report, who had lots of Democrats that were part of that team, as to Mr. Barr. As to whether he did a press conference or not, I just think that's silly. Again, Mr. Barr did not have to actually present this report. He did not have to present a summary, nor did he actually have to release this report. And historically, Department of Justice and prosecutors are absolutely loathe to put out investigatory files because they can be used for political purposes to hurt someone. So in this case, I've been very critical of the president. I thought he should have cooperated with Mueller all the way along, got through this thing as quickly as possible, and then moved on. But in this case, this Justice Department not only has released the summary and the report, but they released, with regards to the collusion issues, almost entirely the report with only one minor redaction. So I can't find, you know, this is just the political carping of trying to find one little thing to nit the president on the press conference side. So on the Congress side, let's see what they want to come up with.
I understand what you're saying, that perhaps legally the attorney general didn't need to issue the report. As a practical matter, he did, didn't he?
Yes. And what I will say is, whether Trump meant to do it or not, when he said, I don't care whether the report releases, let it all out. Politically speaking, I think that's exactly what needed to have happen. You don't want to have this perception that there was some sort of cover-up. Let the report stand on its own 2 feet. Now, there are clearly embarrassing things in there. And, you know, Mr. McGahn probably should get the Presidential Medal of Freedom from Donald Trump from saving the president from himself when you look at elements of that report. But, you know, the bottom line is there's not a lot there other than the fact that you had a president who walked into the office, didn't really know what he was doing well, nor did his staff. He rhetorically and publicly made comments, but that's not conspiracy in the traditional sense. So what you normally prosecute somebody on conspiracy charges are for witness tampering, destruction of evidence or emails, bribery. Those are the usual formulas that are prosecuted for conspiracy, and the president didn't do any of those things. And what he did do was speak out generally publicly.
It does seem, though, that in the report, there's sort of general reference of the campaign, their ignorance of not really being aware of what they were doing and potential violations. On that note, let me bring in from Bloomberg News legal reporter Christian Berthelsen. Thank you so much for joining us. On this issue of whether there was a conspiracy of the Trump campaign to cooperate with Russia, how does the report sort of draw that line as to what would be criminal and what are efforts to glean information or gain help but aren't criminal conspiracy?
Well, I think on this question, the report was sort of more solidly in favor of the president than on the question of obstruction. You're right. I mean, it did define participation or conspiracy with Russia as being criminal if anyone participated in the hacking or in the knowing dissemination of illegal material. And on that point, the special counsel found that no American actually, either with the Trump campaign or otherwise, knowingly participated in that. On the question, the bigger question is the obstruction question, where the special counsel outlined multiple incidents of serious efforts to interfere with the management of investigations, to interfere with the course of investigations, and to interfere or influence the testimony of witnesses that were either cooperating with authorities or going through prosecutions. Including publicly, you know, the discussion of pardons and that sort of thing, in an attempt to influence their how they might talk about Trump's actions. And there, I think it remains a much more sticky situation. Certainly not from a criminal prosecution standpoint, but perhaps from a congressional action standpoint.
Can you explain how? Because there's the incident described in the report where the president tries to get White House counsel Don McGahn to get rid of Mueller for a conflict of interest. McGahn refuses to do that. The president then, according to the report, approaches former campaign chairman Corey Lewandowski, asking him to do that. He doesn't follow through. And essentially, the conclusion is, since the subordinates to the president didn't carry out his orders, that there was not an obstruction that took place. Is it not criminal for a president to attempt to obstruct as opposed to it being effectively carried out?
That is a great question and a complicated question, and I think that's ultimately why the special counsel did not arrive at a conclusion on that. And, you know, it is something that Congress will certainly debate. But you're right. The special counsel noted that in several of the instances of attempted obstruction, the subordinates to President Trump refused to carry out his orders. And as a result, the obstruction was ultimately ineffective. And I think in other parts of the report, it notes that, you know, with limited exception, they were able to carry out their investigation as fully as they wanted to.
We're talking with Christian Berthelsen, who's legal reporter for Bloomberg News, talking about the Mueller report. The redacted version of the report was released at 8 o'clock Pacific time this morning following a news conference an hour and a half earlier by Attorney General Bill Barr. We're talking about the aspects of Mueller's report where there might be any distance between what the Attorney General said and what the actual report says. And, of course, what comes next for Congress. A joint statement was issued today after the release of the report by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. It said the differences are stark between what Attorney General Barr said on obstruction and what Special Counsel Mueller said on obstruction. As we continue to review the report, one thing is clear. Attorney General Barr presented a conclusion that the president did not obstruct justice, while Mueller's report appears to undercut that finding. Christian Berthelsen, I didn't hear Bill Barr in his news conference say the president didn't obstruct justice. I heard him say that the Justice Department doesn't feel that there's evidence to prosecute it. But can you parse that, please?
Sure. I mean, it's a huge distinction. I mean, prosecutors, when they make a prosecutorial decision, when they exercise their discretion, have to analyze a case on the basis of whether they think they can prove it, right? Which is a different standard from whether I think it happened. And in analyzing the evidence that they had collected and in applying the facts against the evidence they collected, they could not come to a conclusion on a criminal threshold that obstruction had occurred, which is to say, it's another way of saying, you know, if we tried to prosecute this in court, we don't have a strong conviction that we would win on that because of several complicating factors that it lays out, including, you know, in some instances, the president actually had the authority to do certain things that he did, like the firing of James Comey. So if you were going to try to build an obstruction case on that basis, the defense could very easily say, you know, the president has the authority to do this. In other instances, things that he did, you know, they examined the context in which he did them. And while they did find some cases which appeared to be, as they described it, if I recall correctly, a garden variety obstruction of justice issue, there were others in which the context made things more complicated. So overall, you know, again, reaching the very high threshold required for a criminal prosecution or a criminal referral, the evidence they had amassed just didn't get them there.
Let's again hear just a portion of Attorney General Bill Barr's news conference where he addressed the decision-making process over whether to prosecute for obstruction of justice.
Although the Deputy Attorney General and I disagreed with some of the special counsel's legal theories and felt that some of the episodes examined did not amount to obstruction as a matter of law, We did not rely solely on that in making our decision. Instead, we accepted the special counsel's legal framework for purposes of our analysis and evaluated the evidence as presented by the special counsel in reaching our conclusions.
So that, again, Attorney General Bill Barr in his news conference this morning. But Christian Berthelsen of Bloomberg, just before I let you go, so this clearly leaves the door fully open for Congress to subpoena witnesses, to follow up on what's included in the Mueller report. And I'm presuming we're going to be seeing for the foreseeable future the House particularly take all this up.
I think you will. I mean, there, and you know, again, it's, you can't deny that sort of the politics does play a role here, and that even with the lower threshold for evidence of a congressional proceeding, you know, there are Democrats who do want to see the facts of the report fully aired. Barr said this morning that there will be an unredacted version provided to certain members of Congress, so they will be able to see in full the report and the evidence that was amassed. So yes, I think you will see that. And I also think, if you notice in the toward the end of the report, there were several, more than a dozen referrals made by the special counsel to other prosecutorial offices for other other potential cases. So you may still see further prosecutions of sort of related and ancillary characters that were involved.
Christian, thank you for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Sure.
Bloomberg News legal reporter Christian Berthelsen with us. And before we let her go, I want to go back to Amanda Renteria, the chair of Emerge America, which works to identify and support Democratic women running for public office. Amanda, what do you think are the most important aspects of the report that the House should follow up on?
There's a couple of them. One, really, it all revolves around obstruction of justice. What happened? What was being done in order to keep justice from the public, in order to really understand what went on here? And I think at the end of the day, the bottom line is, as you look at all this information that's out there and you compare that to with the statements of Barr, I think the reality is the public does need to hear from Mueller. Congress does need to hear from Mueller directly. There's a lot in here. And making sure to be able to ask those questions and for the public to hear directly from the special counsel, I think what comes out of this is that's the bottom line, is there's more questions to be had. And it's difficult to do that when it's when you're speaking through Barr versus actually hearing directly from Special Counsel Mueller.
Amanda, thank you very much. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you.
Amanda Renteria, chair of Emerge America. Also, Sean T. Walsh, Republican political analyst. So, Sean, before I let you go, you want to hear from Mueller testifying before House committees?
I do. You know, as I say, it's in the president's interest. I don't understand where this, you know, the public's been denied access. The report has been 180 pages of the collusion piece, except for a tiny paragraph was released today. So I do think it's in the president's interest to have as much of this stuff out as possible, and the Republican interest. You know, at the end of the day, if the Democrats think there's a problem, they're going to have to go the route of impeachment. I mean, that's really the only way you can deal with a sitting president. And Nancy Pelosi has already expressed an interest that she has no stomach or desire to impeach the president. So I just think this is mostly, I hate to say it, going to be white noise in politics now for several months. The issue is, in my view, we're going to transfer into Trump's taxes and a variety of other issues. But, you know, short of this, it's just going to be more of one side pointing out additional information that they think they should go after, and the other side saying, hey, we're exonerated.
Do you think, Sean, before I let you go, that this moves the needle in terms of potential election effect in 2020?
Well, I think there is ammunition here that if an effective Democrat emerges, that they could use this to try and prosecute the president from a political perspective. And truth is, that's what the founding fathers did. The way you remove a sitting president generally is through an election. And so I think there's plenty here that a Democrat could put up in ads and hurt the president with. And I think the president can use this by saying, you know, there was nothing there. Does it move Republicans who voted for Trump? Probably not a lot. Does it move people who were on the sidelines and didn't vote in the last election? Perhaps.
All right. Sean, thanks so much. We appreciate it. We'll talk with you again soon. Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst with us on Air Talk. In case you just tuned in, Air Talk today, shifting our hours just a little bit. We'll be with you till 1 o'clock this afternoon. Then the BBC News Hour live with the latest on the Mueller report. And then 2 o'clock, All Things Considered, comes your way early. And there'll be plenty more time for that redacted report to be assessed by NPR. Our correspondents, by other folks across the political spectrum, to lay out their thoughts about this and where Congress goes as a follow-up to the Mueller report. Also joining us is Justin Levitt, Loyola Law School professor and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Obama administration's Justice Department. Professor Levitt, great to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me on.
So, as you look at this and sort of how it's being framed, what is the space here for Congress to follow up, particularly on the issue of obstruction or attempts to obstruct the Mueller investigation?
Yeah, I think there are two things that Congress should follow up on. That's certainly one of them. And you mentioned before, the most troubling incident to me seems to be there are plenty of troubling incidents. Let's start there. This is not a healthy respect to the rule of law that we see in this report. The most troubling seems to be the direction to McGahn, the White House counsel, to fire the special counsel, to fire Robert Mueller. And for my money, the most misleading thing that the Attorney General said this morning was that there was no evidence of corrupt motives, or that there was evidence of non-corrupt motives. And that's, I don't know how you read the report and see that. As you said before, it didn't work, but that didn't mean that the president wasn't trying his mightiest to get it to work. And I can't see how you read the report and come to any other conclusion. The second thing that I really hope Congress investigates is what we're going to do going forward. So all of this is backward looking, but contains some incredibly important and alarming information about Russian attempts to interfere with the 2016 elections, and they're not done. We saw continued attempts around the globe to interfere not just in American elections, but in other elections in 2018 and 19. We see that the Trump campaign in the last cycle may not have coordinated or may not have cooperated, but they certainly encouraged and welcomed foreign interference, a foreign attack on American elections. And Congress, we all should be deeply upset about that and focused intently on what we're going to do to ensure that there are no similar encouragements or welcoming of foreign attack on our elections.
And just to clarify, so that isn't a legal issue. This is an ethical issue, a conduct issue, but there's not legal exposure to the president's campaign for that?
Correct. It's a national security issue. It's a policy issue. It's a vitally important American issue, and that's part of why I think Congress should be looking into it. I'm not suggesting that they look into it with the view of relitigating whether there was prosecutable conduct by the president's campaign in that regard. But the conclusions that the report comes to should be deeply alarming to all of us about what we're going to do tomorrow and going forward about interference in the next elections that we have.
Justin Levitt, Loyola Law professor with us on Air Talk. Also with us, a professor of law and community service at Chapman University School of Law, where he directs the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, John Eastman. Professor Eastman, good to have you with us. On this issue of the campaign being at the very least open, if not encouraging, of information damaging to Hillary Clinton's campaign via Russian sources, what do you think is the latitude Congress has to deal with that?
Well, you know, I mean, on something as intensely partisan as this, I always like to step back and look at how similar conduct on the other side of the political aisle was dealt with. And, you know, and to try and see what our norms were and what norms were broken and what kind of action ought to be taken. So for example, you go back to Hillary's campaign and the huge scandal over her email server, the pay-for-play scandal with the Clinton Foundation, And the former president of the United States, her husband, meeting with the then sitting attorney general, who was supposed to be investigating the Hillary Clinton crimes, meeting with him on a tarmac. The kind of obstruction of justice things laid out in this report, the allegations or the evidence, pale in comparison to that. Or you look at the bribing of witnesses that occurred in the whole Monica Lewinsky scandal with Bill Clinton. And so I think we've got to keep this stuff in context. The president was frustrated that his administration was being derailed or attempted to be derailed by a phony narrative about Russia collusion. And, you know, so his comments about get rid of this damn special prosecutor, he's interrupting us, need not be treated, you know, if you want to look at the two sides of that. This is just a ridiculous waste of time because no collusion happened, as this report confirms. Why cripple an administration when what appears to be going on is an attempt to derail the results?
Well, so let's take the hypothetical. Let's say from supporters of the president, the standpoint is there was really not a strong basis for the Mueller investigation. Let's take that as the hypothetical here. If the president attempts to have a subordinate fire the person conducting that investigation, even if the investigation the president and his supporters doesn't believe it justified, why would that still not be an effort to control what is a duly authorized investigation? Why would that not be an attempt to obstruct?
Well, two things. One, the president had the authority to fire any single official in the Department of Justice. That's not obstruction because it was within his authority.
Including Mueller.
Including Mueller, including the attorney general. The president is the nation's top executive. Everybody else hold their power derivatively from him. And if he says, this is a waste of time on an investigation, we're not going to continue to play this charade, and he could fire them. That's not obstruction of justice. That's doing his job. The second piece of that, though, is Mueller was not duly appointed. There has to be evidence of an underlying crime. And there was none. I think Rod Rosenstein and the appointment in the first place, and Andy McCarthy has done some terrific work on this. There was no legal authority to make that appointment in the first place because there was no evidence, convincing or otherwise, of an underlying crime. You did have evidence of Russia intelligence operations, but that's an intelligence operation. That's not a criminal investigation. And the Department of Justice guidelines on appointment of a special prosecutor are very clear. There has to be evidence of an underlying crime by somebody high up in the administration before you can appoint.
Okay, so we're gonna pick up the point you're making then that you don't think this would be in any way obstruction because the president had the right to fire any Justice Department employee, including Robert Mueller, and that Rod Rosenstein, in appointing Mueller to carry out the investigation, that there was not a legal standard that was applied in doing that. We'll hear what our other guest, Justin Levitt of Loyola, has to say about that. You're listening to Air Talk all the way till 1 o'clock this afternoon. The Mueller Report, redacted, released today. We're getting reactions and analysis back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. One particularly dramatic moment captured in the Mueller Report. Mueller's team writes that President Trump was so agitated the day that the special counsel was appointed, May 17th, 2017, that the president slumped back in his chair and declared, "Oh, my God, this is terrible. This is the end of my presidency. I'm effed." That's from the Mueller report, which was released in redacted form today to the public at 8 o'clock Pacific time following a news conference by Attorney General Bill Barr 90 minutes prior to that. We just heard from Chapman University law professor John Eastman, who made the point that the 10 different incidents that are detailed as potential obstruction of the investigation by the president, that this is out of the norm politically when you compare it against previous candidate or presidential conduct, that the standard of obstruction is not consistent here when you look at President Trump's behavior, and also saying that the president was well within his authority to attempt to fire Robert Mueller as the special counsel here. Justin Levitt, Loyola Law Professor, your response to Professor Eastman's contentions.
Yeah, I got to disagree on 3 points in particular. One, the notion that there was no underlying crime here. Foreign military units hacked Americans. They hacked American political servers. That's effectively an act of war, cyber war, but real nevertheless. And more than a dozen individuals have been indicted based on that intrusion. So it's impossible to say there was no underlying crime here.
But it wasn't an underlying crime at that level involving the president or his associates, right?
Mr. Mueller was not engaged with investigating the president. He was engaged with investigating Russian interference in the elections and any coordination or any interaction with campaign officials. And given the president's open call encouraging this attack, it's entirely natural to investigate whether there were, in fact, communications with campaign officials. So the investigation was not only valid but necessary from the get-go. I want to focus on the fact that the campaign invited and encouraged a foreign military attack on Americans, even if you don't think that was a crime in the past. We all should be focused on whether he's going to do it again in the future. I heard Professor Eastman talk about norms and how other presidents have acted or been treated. I cannot recall any sitting president inviting and encouraging a foreign military attack on Americans. And I would hope that we would all be concerned enough about that to take measures precluding such an attack in the future.
And you didn't take that as the president hyperbolically joking. You took it as a serious call.
It's not joking when your three top lieutenants, Donald Trump Jr., your son, your campaign chairman, and your son-in-law tasked with numerous tasks on the campaign and beyond, go take a meeting with the Russian government to find out what information they've got. Now, ultimately, that meeting didn't prove fruitful. But the fact that three of the top people in the campaign went to go find out what the Russian government had, and by the way, we know that they were aware that it was a Russian government meeting, that's seriously disturbing.
We're talking with Justin Levitt, Loyola Law Professor and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Obama administration's Justice Department Civil Rights Division. Also with us, partner in the firm Dorsey & Whitney, former Assistant U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, and former Assistant Special Watergate Prosecutor Nick Ackerman. Mr. Ackerman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Given your experience in investigations involving a president, your thoughts about what the finding is here and whether it makes sense to you that the Justice Department would not prosecute for obstruction of justice.
Well, the only one that would not prosecute for obstruction of justice is William Barr. Let's be clear here. The fact that they couldn't prove that there was a conspiracy with the Russians on either the break-in to the Democratic National Committee or the social media conspiracy that the Russians were involved in is irrelevant as a matter of law. The question is whether or not Donald Trump acted with corrupt intent in trying to stop an FBI investigation. That's exactly what Richard Nixon was named as an unindicted co-conspirator for in the Watergate case. The fact of the matter is clearly, if you take the definition of corrupt intent that the Justice Department provides in every single obstruction case, that is, did he act with an improper purpose and dishonestly to try and obstruct, impede, or influence the due administration of justice, which in this case was an FBI investigation, there can be little doubt that what he was directing James Comey to do was to stop the investigation into Flynn. That in itself, when you take into account what he said later to the Russian ambassador and to Lester Holt, that he wanted to get rid of the Russian investigation by firing Comey, certainly shows plenty of corrupt intent. So what his actual motive was in committing the crime is not an element of the crime.
Why do you think then that Bob Mueller in the report didn't recommend prosecution?
He didn't say he didn't recommend prosecution. He also did it in light of the Justice Department's policy to not prosecute a sitting president. And he made that quite clear in his report. And he wasn't recommending one way or the other. He was simply putting out the facts. And the facts clearly show that Donald Trump could be prosecuted for obstruction of justice, but for the fact of the Justice Department's policy of not indicting a sitting president.
And maybe I misunderstood, so you can clarify this point. I thought that in the Mueller report, they were looking at the obstruction issue independent of whether a president, a sitting president, could be prosecuted for a crime like this.
I think they were looking at it, but I think they make a statement that it was that was part of what was in the back of their mind in making their any kind of recommendation. They recognized that Trump could not be indicted as a sitting president under current Department of Justice guidelines. And I might also point out that this whole business about Barr and his attempt to exonerate Trump from this obstruction count, I mean, this all comes out of his job application memo that he provided the Department of Justice and the White House, you know, last summer looking for this job as attorney general. I mean, first of all, it's based on a total inaccurate legal position on obstruction of justice, where he says it has to be a judicial proceeding, not an FBI investigation. That's just dead wrong. He also says that corrupt intent is just too amorphous and tries to equate it in his report to the fact. Well, not in his report, but actually in his statement today in his press conference saying, well, because Trump's lawyers cooperated with the investigation, that shows lack of intent. I mean, the fact that somebody cooperates with an investigation after they've committed the crime doesn't detract away from the criminal intent that was there at the time the crime was committed. I mean, that just makes no sense. And what he says about corrupt intent in his report, the job application that he submitted to the White House and the DOJ, I mean, it's just incorrect. The Department of Justice every day in an obstruction case very accurately and clearly defines what a jury has to look at to determine what is corrupt intent.
Mr. Ackerman, thank you for being with us. Appreciate it. I know you're very busy today. Thank you, Nick Ackerman, who served as Assistant Special Watergate Prosecutor, now partner in the firm of Dorsey & Whitney in New York City. Let me go back to John Eastman, Chapman University law professor. Mr. Ackerman saying that any other attorney general would prosecute. Your response?
Yeah, you know, I mean, the last two speakers' comments proved my point earlier about how this is just turning into a partisan frenzy. His comment that Bill Barr's op-ed of a year and a half ago was nothing but a job application to President Trump is just one of the Democrat talking points, and it really undermines his credibility on everything else he said.
You don't think that helped convince the president to choose him as attorney general?
I have no idea, but it certainly was not a job application to the president. I mean, that's just a ridiculous talking point.
Well, it's a figure of speech, though, Professor.
Well, no, this is a talking point out of the Democrat talking point memos that are going around. How to describe Bill Barr, you know, and the complete change around on Comey, you know, on Comey is another example. They wanted Comey's head for his press conference right before the election against Hillary. Trump then fires him, and all of a sudden they don't want his head. In fact, they want him protected forevermore. I mean, this
okay.
is overtly partisan. And again, I'll go back to put this in context.
Okay.
Trump's, but let me make this point because
quickly.
Trump's comment that the Loyola professor talked about as inviting a military attack, what nonsense. I mean, what he said
yeah,
was...
he's saying that today's equivalent, not that it was a literal military attack.
No, that's right. But what Trump was commenting on was Hillary and her team using Bleach Bit to illegally clean off her private server that was engaging in classified communications.
Okay.
And he said, well, you know, jokingly, maybe the Russians will have that because they've obviously got other things from the DNC. To say that that's inviting a military attack, even a cyber attack on the United States is laughable.
Professor, I need to break. Jerry Nadler is the chair of the House Judiciary Committee responding to the Mueller report.
He has been disingenuous and misleading in saying the president is clear of wrongdoing. Attorney General Barr's letter summarizing the report from March 24th quoted the special counsel report, quote, "While this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. He ignored what is in the Mueller report just two sentences before, where the special counsel concluded that, quote, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would state so. Based on the facts and the applicable legal standards, however, we are unable to reach that judgment. Obviously, this changes the emphasis and meaning of the paragraph, and obviously he didn't include the key sentences. Second, Special Counsel Mueller went on to say that, quote, a thorough FBI investigation would uncover facts about the campaign and the president personally that the president could have understood to be crimes or that would have risen to personal and political concerns, close quote. For some reason, Attorney General Barr excluded this critical finding as well from his version of events. The Attorney General's decision to withhold the full report from Congress is regrettable, but no longer surprising. Barr has so far refused to work with the committee to provide us with information, the kind of information that has been customarily provided in the past and to which the Judiciary Committee is entitled. These concerns and many others will be addressed when Barr testifies before the committee on May 2nd. Even in its incomplete form, however, the Mueller report, incomplete because part of it is redacted, even in its incomplete form, however, the Mueller report outlines disturbing evidence that President Trump engaged in obstruction of justice and other misconduct. Contrary to the Attorney General's statement this morning that the White House, quote, fully cooperated, unquote, with the investigation, the report makes clear that the president refused to be interviewed by the special counsel and refused to provide written answers to follow-up questions. Page 13, Volume 2, makes clear that his associates destroyed evidence relevant to the Russian investigation. Page 10, Volume 1. The report concluded there was substantial evidence, in quotes, that President Trump attempted to prevent an investigation into his campaign and his own conduct. Page 76, page 78, page 90, page 157, Volume 2. That is why I have formally requested that Special Counsel Mueller testify before the House Judiciary Committee as soon as possible so we can get some answers to these critical questions, because we clearly can't believe what Attorney General Barr tells us. Finally, it is clear the special counsel's office conducted an incredibly thorough investigation in order to preserve the evidence for future investigators. The special counsel made clear that he did not exonerate the president, and the responsibility now falls to Congress to hold the president accountable for his actions. Congress must get the full, unredacted report along with the underlying evidence uncovered by Special Counsel Mueller. Congress requires this material in order to perform our constitutionally mandated responsibilities. Thank you. That's a statement. I'll answer some questions.
Congressman?
Yes.
This is Congressman Jerry Nadler, who is the chair of the House Judiciary Committee.
That's one possibility. There are others. We obviously have to get to the bottom of what happened and take whatever action seems necessary at that time. It's too early to reach those conclusions. It's one reason we wanted the Mueller report. We still want the Mueller report in its entirety, and we want other evidence too.
Congressman Charlie, will Congress proceed with their own obstruction inquiries?
We will proceed with our inquiries. I mean, the first thing we will do is make sure we get the rest of the report and the underlying evidence. We will have Attorney General Barr testify in front of the Judiciary Committee on May 2nd. I anticipate that Mr. Mueller will testify sometime in the next couple of weeks after that, and we will probably hold a series of hearings on other aspects, and we'll see where we go from there.
To go toward impeachment, how important would this report be? Do you think this provides a roadmap?
Well, it's too early to talk about that, you know, because we will have to go follow the evidence where it leads, and I don't know exactly where it will lead. If I did know, I wouldn't need all this information. But certainly, I think from the structure of the report, although I'm a little tentative because I've only skimmed it, we haven't had it very long, I think it was probably written with the intent of providing Congress a roadmap, as other reports have in the past. And but with a lot of the redactions and others, Attorney General Barr seems to be trying to frustrate that intent.
We'll take one more question. One more
Congressman, you said you wanted to hear from Mueller to better understand his findings. Based on what you've seen from the report, what specifically do you want to hear from Mueller about that you already don't have an understanding?
Oh, there are dozens of things we want
to
hear.
Well,
for example, Barr says, or I don't remember where he said it, whether this was verbally or in one of his letters to us, he told us that the special prosecutor's determination that the president, that he wasn't going to indict the president on obstruction charges had nothing to do with the Department of Justice doctrine or opinion that a sitting president is unindictable as a matter of law. There's a lot of material in the report that seems to indicate that that doctrine was considerably important. We'd want to get to the bottom of that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just listen to a live news conference. Jerry Nadler, New York area congressman, who's the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, talking about their intent to have Robert Mueller, special counsel, testify as soon as possible before the committee. Also, the congressman demanding to have a completely unredacted copy of the Mueller investigation. So we'll see what happens with legal efforts of the House, that committee, and intelligence or any other committees that choose to try and get a judge to open up the grand jury testimony that's included in it. Also, to try and get any parts of it that are redacted for security reasons where there might be operative, sensitive individuals' names that are included in the Mueller report. Again, the redacted version of the report was released this morning, 8 o'clock Pacific time. That's given folks about 4 hours now to review what's in the 400-plus pages of it. We're talking about some of the most significant conclusions, what comes next for the House of Representatives as well. You're listening to an extended edition of Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We'll preempt fresh air today. It'll come up tonight, 7 o'clock, right here on 89.3. We have another hour of Air Talk coming your way live, and then at 1 o'clock, the BBC News Hour with its live continuing coverage of the redacted Mueller report, and at 2 o'clock, National Public Radio's All Things Considered with an early airing of the program here on KPCC so that you get continuous coverage throughout the course of the day. I'll be back with the second hour momentarily. Good to have you with us on Air Talk today as we extend our program into this noon hour. Fresh air coming up at 10 o'clock tonight. I'm sorry I gave you the wrong time last hour. 10 o'clock for fresh air tonight here on 89.3 KPECC. Today it's continuing coverage of analysis and reaction to the redacted Mueller report, which was given to Congress and publicly released at 8 o'clock our time this morning. Coming up at 1 o'clock, BBC News Hour. 2 o'clock, an early airing of All Things Considered Live, where you'll hear NPR's ongoing coverage of what's included in the report. We heard from the Attorney General, Bill Barr, this morning at 6:30 our time, in which he said that the determination by the special prosecutor was that there was no conspiracy, or as the Attorney General called it, collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. Also reaffirming that the Justice Department will not be prosecuting anyone within the Trump campaign, including the president, for obstructing justice. However, in the report are 10 separate incidents that that Bob Mueller details as potentially being obstruction of justice. And in that report, Mueller does not come down one way or the other as to whether they are legally actionable, prosecutable, whether there would be a conviction that would come. But the Justice Department, very clearly under Attorney General Barr, is not going to be prosecuting on obstruction of justice. We knew that from the four-page memo that was given to Congress a couple of weeks or so ago. Joining us to talk about what we've gleaned from the report is a professor at the Brooklyn School of Law. She specializes in corporate and white-collar crime, Miriam Baer. Professor Baer, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
So as you look at this, what do you think in terms of the legal analysis by the Attorney General, the decision that justice would not prosecute for obstruction of justice?
Well, I mean, I would start by saying the special counsel's analysis seems very thorough and very straightforward. And one thing I would note as I've been reading this, as compared, you know, there are two volumes. The first volume focuses on the Russian hacking and interference in the election. That section has a lot of redactions because of, you know, its relationship to ongoing investigations. The section on obstruction doesn't. It's very, very lightly redacted. Quite frankly, Attorney General Barr could have released the obstruction volume if he had wanted to fairly quickly. So that's sort of an interesting point, which is that the special counsel really did deliver this in two different volumes, and one reads very differently from the other. It is extremely thorough, both in its analysis of the facts, but also in its analysis of the law. So for each, it breaks it down into each sort of instance of potential obstruction. And then after giving a factual recitation, it then says, here's our analysis of whether there was an obstructive act. Here's our analysis of whether there was what we call a nexus to a proceeding. In other words, there has to be some connection between the act of obstruction and the thing you're trying to obstruct. And here's our analysis of intent. And it's a fairly straightforward document in that it does try to give the president, I would say, credit whenever there's an opposing inference to be made, right? So they say, we did consider there could have been this other reason for why he did X, Y.
Kind of on the one hand, on the other hand.
Mm-hmm. But I would say for several of these that I have read, for example, various things relating to the interactions with Mr. Comey relating to Mr. Flynn, the firing of Flynn and Flynn's the relationship of, for example, I'm reading right now, contacts or efforts to pressure Jeff Sessions. These do not look good under any version of the facts. These look terrible. So whether or not you're talking about someone, you know, putting aside whether someone should be, you know, arrested and prosecuted and convicted, I don't see how one looks at this recitation, which is clearly based in part on, testimony to or statements to the special counsel by Reince Priebus, Doug McGahn. I mean, these are folks who had worked for Donald Trump. As you read through this, it's very hard to call this an exoneration.
I guess I'm just trying to parse the two separate things. And so that's why I was asking you about prosecution or any sort of legal action by the Justice Department versus what Congress could take up and say is conduct by a president that is cause for such concern that we'd move forward with impeachment or at the very least a series of hearings to try and get, in the words of the person making, you know, providing the account, specifics as to presidential conduct. And I mean, these are two distinctly different things, right?
Absolutely. I would say I'm still digesting this and I've been sitting here reading along. I would say several of these probably look less like obstruction. And so I would probably agree that's not something I'm saying as myself as a former prosecutor. I probably wouldn't say I would bring a case solely on that information, but some of them look a lot more like obstruction when you start to lay out all this information. So the getting these messages to Jeff Sessions through Corey Lewandowski to try to pressure Jeff Sessions to effectively shut down the special counsel, that seems very concerning to me. And I have a hard time believing I have a hard time seeing the quote-unquote innocent version of that. So I'm just saying, as I read I find that very concerning.
Miriam Baer with us, Brooklyn Law School professor with us, also joining us, Robert Kaufman, who's Pepperdine University professor of public policy. Professor, thank you for joining us again. As you look at this from a political standpoint, what do you think is reasonable for the House of Representatives to do as a follow-up to this?
Well, I have a legal background, too, and I'm going to make 5 points of what's emerged from this. One, Russia did try to influence the 2016 election. Two, neither Trump nor his campaign conspired with Russia. Three, the president's action did not rise to criminal obstruction of justice. Four, and this is more significant politically, how and why this all began, including getting the process started and the FISA warrants based on the Steele file, the spying on Trump, may be the most significant story of this all. Five, Attorney General Barr is a man of impeccable integrity, as a Washington Post profile made that point 3 weeks ago. And six, honestly, if the Democrats pursue impeachment based on this set of facts, this is a huge political loser for them. Just look at the mathematics. There is no chance, metaphysically, with the composition of the Senate, that this is going to be close to a situation where Trump can be removed. And I don't even think that you're going to get an impeachment effort out of this.
Well, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has said just what you're saying. She's not interested in pursuing it.
It's too flimsy. Democrats don't want to be into this. And one of the things I think you should pay attention to is how little the Democratic candidates on the stump are talking about this, because this is a loser for them. I think if you're looking at independent voters as the swing vote for the election of 2020, the persistence of this effort after the disappointing findings from the standpoint of the Democratic Party is actually going to be a political loser for them if Nadler and others persist.
Before I let you go,
in some ways, I hope they do, because I'm rooting for Trump to win.
All right. Well, before I let you go, though, I wanted to ask you. You said that it did not rise to the level of criminal obstruction of justice.
No underlying crime, and there's no criminal obstruction.
Okay. But hold on. Hold that thought, please. In the report itself, doesn't Bob Mueller punt on that issue and not come down one side or the other as to whether the conduct is criminal?
The fact that Bob Mueller, quote unquote, punted on that issue means that a prosecutor is not going to follow up on that issue as a matter of high probability. So bluntly, I think people who are focusing on that are grasping at straws and missing the larger point, that given the barrage of what we got from CNN, MSNBC, this report is largely an exoneration of President Trump and actually a real indictment of the media, except for Fox, that ironically got this closer to the mark, including the charge by Sean Hannity that this process began with some very troubling procedures. This is a win for President Trump politically, and I think that's going to play out in the coming months,
Professor,
regardless of what the Democrats do. And if they pursue this, I think it's going to be an even bigger win for President Trump.
Professor Kaufman, thank you for being with us. That's Robert Kaufman, public policy professor at Pepperdine. He's author of Dangerous Doctrine, How Obama's Grand Strategy Weakened America. Also with us, Loyola Law professor Lori Levinson, former federal prosecutor. Professor Levinson, on this matter of obstruction of justice, after looking at that portion of the report for whatever time you've had to do that, why do you think Mueller didn't come down with a recommendation?
Well, you know, I totally disagree with your prior speaker. I don't know if he's reading the same report I am, because right in the report, Mueller says that he's perfectly capable of saying that there was no actions by the president, if that's what, in fact, it was. But he, in fact, comes out and says, we do not exonerate him. And the reason in my mind as a law professor is that even though I think there's plenty in this report to show inappropriate, unethical, wrong behavior, it may not rise to what we require for criminal obstruction. And not for reasons that the president didn't go off course, but because we have standards of corrupt intent that relate to, did you know it was against the law, and did you actually obstruct? And there were a lot of things happening in the White House that actually prevented it from becoming obstruction, none of which you could really credit to the president himself.
Well, you're just referencing sort of the claimed ignorance on the part of those who took meetings with people associated with the Russian government. How is that a defense against potential criminal action?
Well, for some of the crimes that are charged, you have to have what we would call specific intent or a higher level of intent, which is you have to be saying this because you want to interfere with a criminal investigation, and it's raised in this report whether subpoenas have gone out and what stage the investigation's at, or whether you're just doing it for your own sort of selfish political purposes. So I think the best you can say is from this report that Trump might have always just be considering of his political purposes and sort of, you know, whatever happens that needs to get him there, that's fine. And on the other hand, I want to say there are lines in this report you cannot ignore where, for example, page 155, Mueller says the evidence could support an inference that the president was aware of these facts about Cohen's false statements going to Congress. So it's not that he says that the president didn't want this to happen or he had no idea it would happen, but what he says is, when you go and bring criminal charges, you're going to have to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. And I don't know whether this theory or amount of evidence will be enough.
Professor, how difficult, if at all, will it be for House committees to get a copy, get a judge to, at least for the grand jury testimony parts of the report, have that unmasked for the members of Congress?
That's hard to say because you have to almost know which judge it is. I'm not sure that there's a lot they have to have unmasked in terms of the grand jury front. I think much of what the House and the Democrats will want to use is actually openly in the report. But the legal standard, to answer your question, Larry, is whether there's, quote, a particularized need. And so they will need their legal counsels. Some of those on the House committee, such as Adam Schiff, would meet the bill there, draw up why this relates to their specific investigation and why this information, frankly, is not otherwise obtainable to do that investigation.
Loyola Law Professor Lori Levinson with us, Brooklyn Law School Professor Miriam Baer as well. We have more guests who'll be joining us as we bring you continuing coverage of the release of the redacted version of the Mueller report, Congress and the public getting it at 8 o'clock this morning. Our coverage continues throughout the course of the day, BBC NewsHour at 1, All Things Considered, with an early start at 2 o'clock today. And if you tuned in for Fresh Air, it'll come your way 10 o'clock tonight right here on 89.3. I'll be back in just a minute. Bringing you many different voices, legal and political responses to the release of the redacted Mueller report. It's an extended air talk today up until 1 o'clock on 89.3 KPECC. Also coming up later this hour, conversation with Governor Gavin Newsom. I spoke with him late yesterday on the occasion of his 100th day in office. We'll have that conversation for you coming up a little bit later this hour on an extended air talk. I'm speaking with law professors from Loyola, Lori Levinson from Brooklyn Law School, Miriam Baer, and also from Hofstra University on Long Island, Professor of Constitutional Law Eric Friedman. Professor, thank you for being with us. Professor Friedman, you there? All right. We'll try and get you on the line. Let me go back to Miriam Baer of Brooklyn Law School. We had a listener, Jeff, in Redlands, wondering if the Steele dossier is mentioned at all in the report. This, of course, has been, for many supporters of the president, a source of ire that the Steele dossier was credited as potentially having accurate information about the president's associations with Russia, as well as his conduct on visits to Russia, as well as that being a partial basis for the Carter Page FISA warrant. Do you know, Professor Baer, if it's mentioned at all here?
Well, it's mentioned in two ways. It's mentioned in Volume 1, which is the factual results of the special counsel's investigation of Russian interference, although there a lot of time is spent talking about really efforts of Russia through the GRU, in fact, in this Internet Research Agency, to basically use social media to basically support President Trump, then candidate Trump, and then on top of that, the hacking efforts. But it's mentioned in there. Where it actually also shows up, interestingly enough, is in the obstruction section. So there's a discussion in there leading up to James Comey's ultimate firing, right, about the fact that Comey actually briefs President Trump on the Steele dossier and certain aspects of the Steele dossier. So it certainly shows up in there, as it shows up in two different ways.
All right. We were talking earlier with Pepperdine University professor about he's talking about the FBI's conduct on this and how the whole investigation got started. Do you think that this was from the beginning a defensible investigation, or that there's anything in the origins of it that calls it into question as nakedly political?
Well, I think in terms of, the political aspects of it, this is a very broad investigation. I don't understand how you can deny the harm that is described in Volume 1 that is directed at the United States. In other words, there is a long discussion of efforts by Russia through various entities to harm our election, to undermine our election process, to get into people's email accounts, right? To find out, I mean, there's all sorts of discussion in there, not just even to get a hold of passwords and follow what people are doing in terms of, basically see what they're doing in terms of keystrokes and things like that. In other words, really basically take over your computer type of stuff. And I would think that wherever you fall on the political spectrum, you would be concerned by that, right? So there's quite a bit in there, especially Volume 1, that really ought to cause bipartisan concern.
Professor Levinson, Loyola Law School, do you think that the investigation, as it turns to the Trump campaign, that is completely legally justified?
Oh, I do think that there was a basis, and it comes out in the report. I agree always with Professor Baer, and particularly in this situation. As you read the report, Mueller is very careful to point out that there was a lot of information here, and that, and frankly, even culturally, it's understandable why the people in law enforcement, like Comey and others in the FBI, were concerned. Because as she described, rather than a president saying, oh my God, look at how people tampered with our legal system, look at how they affected the legitimacy of our legal system, it was more just retweeting it, sort of saying, how will this affect me personally? So the focus wasn't so much on the damage to the United States. It really was a very personal political concern that the president had, according to the report by Robert Mueller.
Also with us, Professor Emeritus, Syracuse University School of Law. He's also Professor Emeritus, Public Administration and International Affairs, William Banks. Professor Banks, we appreciate your time. We have a question from one of our listeners, John in Highland Park. Why weren't the president's son, Don Jr., and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, questioned as a part of the investigation, given the meeting in Trump Tower with Russian-connected individuals?
That is one of the main remaining questions after reading that part of the report. There's no clear answer to it. All we can do is guess. And maybe the best guess is that they thought on the basis of the statements that they had from others and the sort of corroborating evidence that had been reported by others, that at most they would have hearsay with respect to Don Jr. or Kushner on those particular events, or hearsay which would not be able to stand up in a criminal prosecution.
Also, the question here of, since nothing came out of the Trump Tower meeting, does that also in some way diffuse the allegation that there was an effort to conspire with the Russian government, or is that irrelevant to the potential of making a criminal case?
I think, legally it's irrelevant because it would then depend on the other factors and facts that were found by examining other potential witness statements. As two of your recent respondents, legal academics, pointed out, the underlying tenor of the investigation going back to that time was on the Russian activities themselves. It was fundamentally a counterintelligence investigation about Russian meddling in the election. And as I think the report confirms, that was a very serious investigation about a remarkably important and difficult problem.
We're talking with Professor Emeritus, Syracuse University, William Banks, talking about the Mueller report. Extended coverage on Air Talk today until 1 o'clock. The redacted version of the report released at 8 o'clock this morning. Professor Banks, we just heard from Jerry Nadler, who's the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, that there's concern over what's redacted in the report. Given the points in the report where the redactions occur, is there any way to discern whether it's likely of a high degree of significance what's not included versus what we know is in the report? You see that sort of more as political theater, what Nadler is calling for, that there might be very significant information omitted.
After observing the conduct of Attorney General Barr and his DOJ senior staff in recent days, I feared significant redactions about things that would have been otherwise embarrassing or possibly even incriminating for members of the Trump circle. When I'm certainly not through the entire report yet, but looking it over and skimming the parts I haven't read, I think there are fewer redactions of more import than I had expected. And indeed, those that Nadler might be concerned about will come to light in most of them in the coming days and weeks. Grand jury category will clear up when grand juries complete their work. The stuff that's subject to congressional investigation will clear up once those investigations proceed and receive or decide their own agenda. And I think the peripheral materials on so-called third party matters were pretty minor as far as we can tell.
And do you think that Bob Mueller will agree to testify before House committees? And do you think that he will be free to talk about, to answer most of the questions directed to him?
I think the answer is yes to both. I think that's Mueller's MO and has been from the beginning and indeed throughout his career, doing what he's expected to do as a public servant. He's the quintessential public servant. It certainly behooves him to tell what he can to the congressional committees. This was a report to educate us more than anything else, particularly since there are no other criminal prosecutions that are going to arise directly from the report. So it's a far broader audience to speak to congressional committees and then have that testimony reported widely than it is for those of us who are pour our way through a 400 and some page report.
We have a listener, Kate, who is in Silver Lake, says if there were Americans in the room with Russians who indicated willingness to illegally affect an American election, how is it not obstruction of justice for that not to be reported to authorities? Professor Banks, is there an obligation to report if you have evidence that people are attempting to break the law?
in general, in our legal system, no, we don't have an obligation to report crimes unless it's a crime of violence and we're immediately able to do something about it by reporting it. Those conversations that your listener might be referring to are known to us because our intelligence community was engaging in electronic surveillance of the Russians, known foreign agents, and the fact that they happened to be in a room talking with Americans, the collection of the conversation involving Americans would have been incidental to the purpose of collecting the foreign intelligence. What are the Russians up to? I think we certainly learned a great deal from that electronic surveillance, but it's not, I think, the case that the Americans, on the other hand, were legally responsible for going to the authorities at that time. And indeed, the authorities knew about the conversations at the pretty much contemporaneously.
Professor Banks, quick question before I let you go, and that is, short of impeachment, what is available to the House of Representatives to deal with what we're hearing from Democrats, their view that President Trump, members of his campaign, were engaged in, if not criminal conduct, malfeasance?
Well, I think it's hard for the House to act alone because to make legislation, of course, the Senate would have to agree, and that's going to be problematic, but maybe not impossible in some cases. One of the things they can attempt to do is to build up the oversight structures so that there's more regular oversight of White House activities and of agencies that are directly subordinate to the direction and control of the White House. I think we may well see that. And Congress certainly has the authority to enhance and strengthen its oversight infrastructure and to carry out whatever investigations they deem necessary to follow through on their constitutional powers. So I think that can be effective. Legal change in terms of new statutory controls on the administration are going to be difficult to effect unless the standing of the president and the Senate of the United States deteriorates.
Professor Banks, we appreciate your being with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Syracuse University Professor Emeritus of Law, Public Administration and International Affairs, William Banks. And my thanks to Brooklyn Law School Professor Miriam Baer and Lori Levinson, who frequently joins us on Air Talk, professor at Loyola Law School here in Los Angeles and a former federal prosecutor. Coming up right after our update, we're going to hear a conversation with Governor Gavin Newsom. I spoke with him late yesterday on the occasion of his 100th day in office. Also, a reminder, Film Week comes your way tomorrow on 89.3, the horror film The Curse of La Llorona. Also, The Man Who Killed Don Quixote from director Terry Gilliam. It's taken years to get that movie to the screen. Coming up, a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to a special extended edition of Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, taking you up to 1 o'clock, and the BBC News Hour, 2 o'clock, early start today of All Things Considered. I spoke late yesterday with Governor Gavin Newsom on the occasion of his first 100 days in office, and I started by asking the governor about his announcement of a prescription drug purchasing program, leveraging public entities in the state, and how the program works.
Well, it's going to save hundreds of millions of dollars in the next few years, billions of dollars on an annual basis if we do it right and get counties like Los Angeles that committed today to join our statewide purchasing pool to subsequently join. The goal is this, large volume, lower prices. And California currently is spending close to $13 billion every year on pharmaceutical drugs. But we are not doing it in a rational way. We're not doing it in a coordinated way. That is changing.
So is this for all Medi-Cal recipients? What other categories of patients would be included?
Yeah, remarkably as significant as Medi-Cal is, and it is indeed 13 million strong in that program, but our corrections department, our state hospitals, leveraging the work that's done at the VA, our retirement system, CalPERS, all of these disparate agencies are independently purchasing pharmaceutical drugs. Interestingly, even under the Medi-Cal system, we're not leveraging all 13 million participants. It actually is done by individual managed plans, and we're changing that as well. So we are now one of the largest purchasers of drugs in the United States. No state at scale is doing what we're doing. And what's so exciting about today was to get L.A. County, the second largest purchaser of pharmaceutical drugs, to join the state efforts. And now we're getting calls from other governors that are potentially looking to join as well. It's really an exciting space that means a lot to people listening because it means lower drug prices, lower health care costs.
We're talking with Governor Gavin Newsom, his first 100 days in office. A wide range of topics for us to cover, including opposition to Senate Bill 50, which would allow for development along transit corridors, even along heavily traveled streets. That's incurred the wrath of Southern California communities. L.A. City Council unanimously voted to oppose SB 50. San Francisco, similarly. So, Governor Newsom, I'm wondering your view about Senator Wiener's bill that would allow for this development. Do you support it?
Yeah, look, it's a work in progress, and we are in the middle of negotiating a series of housing-related bills, including a potential rent cap in California. SB 50 is part of that broader conversation. But let me just, on the issues, speak to this. We have an affordability crisis in California. The California dream is at peril. Social mobility is stopped in its track. The biggest issue for me in this state is the cost of living. It's manifesting in a homeless crisis, the likes of which this nation has never seen, let alone our state. We're 49th out of 50th in per capita housing production. Only Utah builds less housing. We've got to get serious. And so regardless of the details of the bill, which are profoundly important, which is density around transit corridors, the spirit of what Scott Wiener is trying to advance is critical. We simply cannot deny the fact that we can change the status quo unless we get serious about increasing the production of housing in the state.
As you know, communities like the San Fernando Valley, the west side of Los Angeles, are concerned that along major thoroughfares, single-family homes just a block off would be knocked down, large apartment buildings would go up, and it would dramatically change the character of those communities, and that the housing created would not be affordable. It would be high-cost housing. So would you want to see those streets removed from the senator's plan, or what's the answer there?
Yeah, the answer is one size doesn't fit all, and that's the struggle the senator has, not only this year, but he had this last year when he had a similar bill. And communities are different. Transit corridors are defined differently in different communities. Some communities are more dense, others less so. West sides versus east sides of communities are radically different. So that's the struggle. Look, I'm not applying any recommendation here. I'm just applying the larger thrust that we've got to go from an annual production of about 100,000 housing units in California closer to 300,000 to 400,000 if we're going to deal with the issue of affordability and the crisis. We can oppose things. We could deny others their proposals or their approaches. But I think collectively we together have to own up to the production gap. And we're going to have to focus on the smartest ways of producing. And I do think that's density around transit corridors. But again, appreciating the nuance to which you have described and the complexity to which you described this issue. And that's why I think the bill is struggling. The bill just struggled last year. But the stress and emphasis on getting housing going and moving again, I think, is an important one.
We're talking with Governor Gavin Newsom on the occasion of his 100th day in office. Education, huge issue. We've seen teacher strikes in Los Angeles, Oakland, Sacramento, and obviously public concern for public education is high. What's your view, though, of creating new charter schools? You had said that, you know, there's a place for charter schools, but can they continue to be created at the same pace as they have been the last several years?
Yeah, no, look, I was very proud to get a legislative a compromise 11 years in the making on more transparency provisions for charter schools. This is something, as I said, over a decade we weren't successful in moving this legislation. We were able to fast track it and get to my desk within the first 60 days in office. I believe in high quality nonprofit charters. I think it's time to focus on quality, not quantity. The stresses in Los Angeles and Oakland that led to the strikes, led to action on the street, were in no small part because of the issue of charters, but also the elephant, which is the obvious, and that is the issue of pension and the costs and the burdens on our local school districts. This is a profoundly challenging issue. The issue has been brought to the fore in the three examples you cited. I can assure you there are at least a half dozen other districts feeling the same financial pressure in this economy. We can imagine when the recession comes. I put $80.7 billion in the budget this year. It's an historic amount of money for our K through 12 education system, K through 14. We also put $3 billion to address some of the pension liabilities through a supplemental payment. We're not out of the woods. We need more investment in public schools, and we are looking to potentially address that on the 2020 ballot.
Governor Gavin Newsom with us, 100 days as California governor. In Aliso Canyon in the San Fernando Valley Porter Ranch community, when you were campaigning, you said you supported closing the huge natural gas storage facility underground in Aliso Canyon. Are you taking any action to bring that closure about?
Yeah, and the excise issues, these are tough issues. We put some money in the budget. We are trying to bring folks together on this issue. I'm, as a point person, I've led or I've asked my new EPA director, Jared Blumenfeld, who worked in the Obama administration, representing the Obama administration in the western states. He is my lead on this effort, and he is engaging stakeholders, and we are doing it very deliberatively. Again, just 100 days, so I don't want to overpromise the progress, but I am fully committed to achieving that goal.
So you, for you, it's what, finding other sources of storage, or what are you looking at before you'd be willing to order it closed?
Yeah, it's a transitionary challenge. I mean, you can't just shut down. I'm dealing with this from a broader fracking perspective. We're dealing this from perspective of shutting down the last nuclear plant in California, which generates anywhere from 6 to 9% of our electricity needs. You can't just overnight shut something down. Is understandably popular as that may be, one has to deal with the consequences. There's also a legal process, and forgive me for the pragmatism of governing. It's easier from the outside just to assert, but my goal is the same as the advocates, the community, specifically the surrounding communities. I was the chair of the State Lands Commission. This was brought to our attention there. We held a number of hearings. I deeply understand the emotion that's driven from this. And so we are committed to that process in a reinvigorated way with respect Governor Brown was, but with, I think, a little bit more. I don't mean this as an indictment and this is not a point of controversy, but a little more passivity than I can assure you this administration is advancing, particularly with Jared Blumenfeld, who shares my vision and actually has a history when he worked in the Obama administration in terms of his desire and his need in, to achieve this ultimate goal.
Governor Gavin Newsom with us on Air Talk, 100 days in office. You have issued a moratorium on executions in California. This just a couple years after the majority of California voters supported a reform as opposed to abolishing the death penalty. You've had pushback from some of the family members, survivors of victims of killers in California. What do you say to those who say this was an executive overreach on your part? Better to let California voters make the decision.
I appreciate that. I am afforded the right and responsibility to sign off on every execution. It's the governor's signature is attached to that final execution. In a premeditated way, I can't take another person's life. That is something I was very clear about during my time out on the campaign trail. That said, to answer your question specifically, I completely respect people that share a different point of view. It is a very, very emotional issue. I met with victims' families. They told me directly in the governor's office that they shared that point of view of condemnation to my decision and determination. But look, it's, from my humble perspective, a system that is flawed, a system that disproportionately hurts poor people and people of color. I cannot in good conscience ultimately take the life of another individual in a premeditated way, knowing that in some cases there is a chance that we'll be executing someone who's found, that subsequently will be found innocent. Let me be more specific. Just last year, we had someone who served close to 26 years in death row that was exonerated, found innocent. 165 people now in this country as well. It is not a deterrent. We have spent $5 billion to execute 13 people. It's costly. It's wasteful. And in many cases, it does not provide the closure that some believe. And I get that not from my own perspective, but from the perspective of victims that have also shared their opposition to executing individuals that have actually killed members of their family, that said, I don't have the right to take the life in the name of their daughter or son. It's a very, very emotionally charged issue. I do not believe in the death penalty. I think this country can do more and do better. California is the largest death row, and I hope we can make an impact on this debate.
Gavin Newsom, California governor, with us on Air Talk, 100 days in office. The goal is, I know you've stated this, to cover more Californians via Medi-Cal, regardless of immigration status. There are a couple of bills in the legislature asking for Medi-Cal to expand regardless of age, above age 26, for those who are undocumented. Is that realistic? Could the state possibly find the funds to do it? Is that the right thing to do?
Well, I did it as mayor of San Francisco. We provided universal health care, fully implemented it, regardless of pre-existing condition, ability to pay, and regardless of your immigration status. So it's a stated goal of mine. It's actually a specific task that I was privileged enough to implement in my previous capacity as mayor. As governor, now and again, my 100th day, I submitted a budget in January. I'll be updating that budget next month in May that commits to expanding that coverage up to the age of 26. And so the answer to your question is twofold. The answer is yes, I believe in the goal, and no, that today I don't believe we have the resources to achieve it universally yet, but we're making a down payment, getting up to 26, and then we will build off that in the next few years.
Governor Newsom, you're recently back from El Salvador, where you went on what you called a fact-finding trip. What did you find about immigration to the United States, migrants leaving El Salvador coming here?
Well, I wanted to put a human face on immigration. I can't stand the rhetoric coming out of the Trump administration. I'm disgusted by it. Not as governor, but as a human being, as a fifth-generation Californian that prides itself on living in a state where 27% of us are foreign-born. We need to stand up against Trump and Trumpism, and we need to push back, and we need to do so by putting some humanity front and center in this debate. And so my purpose was to say to folks in El Salvador, of which we have the largest Salvadoran population in the United States, that they matter and we care. And that people fleeing persecution and violence that are legally coming to the United States, legally seeking asylum, that Californians stand out in direct contrast to the administration in Washington, D.C. I got to tell you, it was beyond rewarding spending 2.5 days there, learning of the complexities and nuances of this issue, being able to communicate that message to the current president and the president-elect and to the people of El Salvador and so many families that have family members here in California that are in El Salvador that heard that message, and also to express this, a deeper understanding of sanctuary policy. Our entire sanctuary policy, which is front and center in our national discourse today, emanates from the from the Civil War in Central America, in El Salvador and Nicaragua, our cities of refuge that ultimately became sanctuary cities, our state sanctuary policy. I have a deeper level of understanding and nuance, the complexities of MS-13 versus 18th Street Gang, and final point, the geopolitical understandings now of how China is asserting itself in this region as the United States pulls away from foreign aid, U.S. aid, MCC, and INL aid. China is popping champagne corks because they are now asserting themselves in a way to gain influence as the United States pulls away, which just reinforces the absolute absurdity of Trump administration's policies. And I saw firsthand that foreign aid at work and how it's saving lives and reducing migration. We are as dumb as we want to be as a nation. We've got to push back on these failed policies of the Trump administration.
Governor Newsom, if hypothetically the federal government started bringing migrants from Central America, from Mexico, into California because of what the president said about taking them to sanctuary cities, would California have the resources to be able to provide services for those who arrived?
Well, they're already doing that. The Trump administration, and forgive the language, has been dumping legal migrants, children, out on the streets and sidewalks in sanctuary cities like San Diego. Every single day, dozens of families are thrown out on the streets to fend for themselves, end up, in some cases, homeless, trafficked. That's not a gross exaggeration, in the emergency room. And we changed that. One of the first actions I took as governor, with the incredible leadership of our legislature, we did a fast-tracked appropriation to create a migrant facility, a modest amount of money to create a facility to give people dignity and to allow them to not end up on the streets in an orderly fashion, end up in other parts of not only our state, but across this country. So the reality is the administration's already been doing that, not with stated intent, not a policy that the president has purposely advanced, but one that clearly has been exercised in California for some time.
All right. I thank you, Governor Newsom, for being with us. If you'd like to close with just your plans next 100 days in office, do you have firm goals established?
Yeah, a strong budget, a budget that reflects the values of our state, and a budget that is in stark contrast with Trump. We're not, you know, we are an un-Trump state. There's no doubt about that. But we're not just a state of resistance. We're the positive alternative to Trump and Trumpism. And I think you're seeing on health care, on education, the environment, on the work we're doing, on so many issues that we are standing not only tall in opposition, but we're really painting in bold strokes a positive alternative agenda. I'm really proud of California, Californians, and I mean this in the core of my soul. The best is yet to come in this state.
Governor Newsom, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Governor Gavin Newsom, 100th day in office yesterday. I spoke with him yesterday afternoon. Stay tuned right after this extended air talk. It's BBC NewsHour at 1 o'clock. And all things considered, with an early start today at 2, you'll hear coverage of the release of the redacted Mueller report, reactions to it from across the spectrum, as well as analysis of what's in the report. I'm going to be off tomorrow. My father's having surgery. I'm going to be with him tomorrow. I'll be off Monday as well. Libby Denkman will be hosting for me, and John Horn will be hosting Film Week tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. Have a terrific afternoon. Stay tuned to 89.3 KPECC for continuing coverage on reaction to the redacted Mueller report.